Welcome to the Sagebrush Variety Show. SagebrushVariety.org, political commentary and satire. On this week's show, we've got the Peak Oil Check-In by Carl Ettmeyer, Better Government Monitoring of Gasoline and Oil Supply Needed. And the next installment of our current radio play, Ukiah Digby for Coroner, the Sagebrush Variety Show Farm Report on arugula. And on this week's essay, corporatists also want to get out the vote. But first, Bucky Bacaw's Backyard Chicken broadcast with actor Chicken Neem, gearing up for this year's Idaho International Film Festival. I'm producer Gwen Sankirico. Enjoy the show.
This is Bucky Bacaw with the Backyard Chicken Broadcast. In 2005, a member of the Bacaw flock, Neem, a bantam cochin, who at the time was a fresh young hen, just barely in the flush of her adulthood, and I, using my stage name, Robert McMinn, auditioned for and were accepted for lead roles in a short film made by independent producers Full Tilt Boogie. The short role became a part in several other stories within a story, which was then tied together as the feature film Works Insanity, which premieres September 25th and 26th, 2008, in Boise, Idaho. In our first film, Neem played the role of Pet Chicken, opposite my aging hipster character, who is dating an attractive older woman with a troubled young son. Scenes from that short include Neem sitting on my shoulder as I ride a bicycle to my date. As discussed on previous shows, two of my passions are bicycle transportation and urban agriculture, simple solutions to some of our contemporary problems caused by the rising price of oil and other dwindling resources. Interests my on-screen character shared. As for Neem, she and I discovered early on in our chicken and chickener bonding that she finds it supremely relaxing to go for a ride with me. She knows when I'm about to take her somewhere. She's surely excited because the destination is usually a friend's house, where we'll be doing backyard chicken outreach, demonstrating the awesome ability of a hen to rid a backyard of earwigs, doodlebugs, and other plant-eating insects without the use of toxic pesticides. However, we both know that the destination is only half the experience. As soon as I pick her up for one of these journeys, she relaxes on my shoulder. As I mount my bike and begin moving, she makes a few minor adjustments for her comfort and settles into the feeling of the wind rustling through her feathers and moving her beak around to take in the exciting scents along the way. I ride slowly, of course, and she's been known to even take a little catnap on longer journeys. When we recreated our rides for the movie, we made sure she was rewarded with plenty of bugs, since our locations were places that had not been treated with pesticides and had plenty of bugs vexing our hosts. So not only did we impress the crew with our acting abilities, but also with Neem's skill as a garden helper. She even deposited some nutrient-rich poop in her wake as a bonus. We also filmed a classic chicken crossing the road scene. In it, Neem's adorable feather-adorned cochin legs race across a street, which we closed to traffic, to get to the other side, where I was imitating the sound of a rooster dispensing treats to a favorite hen and stood ready with worms. She rose to the occasion by showing a genuine enthusiasm. That short was titled Thai Chicken, a play on the popular dish, which I only recommend cooking for those who live in a truly food-sustainable context and must cull some chickens, humanely and after providing a wonderful life, in order to meet their protein requirements. The other side of the Thai chicken pun is that for our mental and physical health, Neem and I, as well as our on-screen alter egos, like to do a variation of the Chinese Tai Chi exercise, with Neem perching on my arms and legs as I do slow and controlled movements throughout my muscle range. In the movie, this is filmed as a dream sequence. For our reprise roles, we played a middle-aged guy struggling to find a higher purpose in life who shares his small yard and vintage camper with a chicken who provides eggs, garden assistance, and inspiration as he writes his novel on a perhaps magical typewriter. This was a tougher shoot for Neem, as she was required to sit in a hot trailer, observing the drama between me and my estranged wife. A grueling scene to film for all, but we made sure we sprayed her down with cool water frequently and gave her lots of food and attention. She was the consummate professional, and the filmmakers, Chad and Cecilia Wren, were grateful for the poignant reaction shots she blessed us with. The scenes worked out so well that Chad tried to dream up ways to alter his script to include her in more of the movies, but in the end, she is just seen in some key shots during the larger narrative that ties the stories within a story together. The revolving crew we worked with during the filming, which spanned 3 years, still talk about how delightful it was to work with a chicken and how impressed they were with her ability to work even between scenes at debugging and fertilizing our locations. Indeed, Neem and I were approached to consider performing several other film roles together, but I had to move from Boise to New York before we could pursue those opportunities. While Neem clearly enjoyed her foray into acting, she seems just as happy in her retirement to an excellent backyard farm managed by one of the Sagebrush Variety players who was heavily involved in the show that launched Bucky Bacall's Backyard Chicken broadcast. But her retirement may not be permanent. You never know when she'll be recruited for another screen appearance. We're not interested in putting her on an airplane to film at other locations, but I'd be more than willing to fly back to Boise for the right role as co-star or chicken wrangler. One of my favorite behind-the-scenes stories occurred during one of the long periods of downtime between our shoots. For many actors, these chunks of time are notoriously boring, even maddening, but Neem and I were determined to make the best of it. At one point, the camera crew needed to get exterior and background shots at the trailer park location. It was going to take an indeterminate but likely long time, and we would be needed right after. So I asked that we be dropped off at a spot on the border between a public park and ambulance parking lot. There was a compost demonstration project at the site, and I figured Neem could get a good snack there, and I could indulge in one of my other interests, composting. We were not in Boise for this scene, but in nearby Garden City, which is well known for its suspicious police and their sometimes hair-trigger tempers and tendency towards excessive force. Right in the middle of an especially fruitful discovery of an earwig nest, a patrol car rode up, and I could hear the dispatcher on the radio describing me and Neem to the policeman. He got out of his car and said, "I have a report of a suspicious chicken and man." I said, "Oh." And he said, "What's going on?" I explained about the movie, and after looking around and not seeing any cameras, the policeman asked for my ID. He returned to the squad car and radioed in my information. Still not satisfied with the results of my ID search, he returned and peppered me with questions. "What is this movie? Who's making it? Do you have a permit to film? Is this your chicken, or did you rent it?" I was trying to answer as politely as I could, without letting my impatience with the needless intrusion show, and keeping an eye on Neem lest she wanders too far, when he asked the question that would be my salvation. "What kind of chicken is that?" Without even thinking about what I was doing, I launched into my full Bucky Bacall mode, going into a detailed explanation about the characteristics of the Cochin breed, the difference between bantam and full-size chickens, the history of chicken breeding in North America, etc. Just as I was about to transition into a speech about the golden Seabright breeds, the squad car radio squawked, and the policeman curtly said, "I gotta go," and left me in peace. To find out the themes Neem and I touched on as actors in Work's Insanity, you'll need to attend the Idaho International Film Festival in Boise, or purchase the DVD online at ftbproductions.com. But equally as enlightening is the moral of our behind-the-scenes story. The fact is that becoming a backyard chickener is a wise thing to do, because chickens provide pesticide-free bug control, garden tilling, compost acceleration and fertilizer production, as well as fresh eggs. But on another level of transformation, their companionship is often a catalyst for the chickener and the chicken to discover new possibilities for personal enrichment, and in our case, for creating enduring art. This is Bucky Bacall. I had a good time. Bucky Bacall's Backyard Chicken Broadcast is produced by the Sagebrush Variety Show with support from Boise Community Radio and the Green Institute. For more information, visit buckybacall.org. BUCKYBUCKAW.org.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil. Last week, I described on the Peak Oil Check-In a situation that wasn't getting much play in the national media. Regional shortages of gasoline and other refined products in the wake of Hurricanes Gustav and Ike. This week, the national media are paying some attention, even though the larger story of the meltdown of the U.S. financial sector is, rightfully, dominating headlines. The U.S. paper of record, the New York Times, had a short article on Sunday reporting fuel shortages and long gas lines in Atlanta, Nashville, and Tallahassee. The article quoted Jason Toews, founder of GasBuddy.com, as predicting the shortages would last another week or two. Local reporting confirms the view in the Times. The website of the NBC TV affiliate in Atlanta said Monday that many gas stations there that did have gas had only a single pump open, or were offering only a single grade of gasoline. In response to the shortages, the Nashville City paper published an editorial Monday that I liked so much I thought I would read an unusually long excerpt of it. The editorial's philosophy is equally applicable to the acute shortages now being experienced in the Southeast, the chronic fuel shortages we're all likely to face as world oil production drops after peak oil, and the financial sector's meltdown. The headline of the Nashville City paper's editorial is, "Governments should keep populace informed on gasoline." Here's some of what it says. As America tries to change its attitude about energy sources and consumption, it is imperative that governments keep up, not just in terms of regulations, but in guiding the populace. After all, what is leadership, or governance for that matter, other than guidance? How about if governments started the process with just a little old-fashioned information and some accompanying suggestions? There was a growing sense of panic in Nashville and surrounding Middle Tennessee counties last week that hit a crescendo Friday around lunchtime. The problem? The region was clearly running out of gasoline. Filling station after station sat with cellophane bags draped over pump handles. Angry motorists, many of them working-class folks, sat idly in long lines that stretched down city blocks, waiting for their turn at gas stations lucky enough to have product. Gasoline has slowly started making its way back to Middle Tennessee pumps. The question now is, what have we as a community learned from this mess? Let's start with a lesson for governments, both state and local. Government does not need to treat gasoline availability like a market issue. Government needs to stay on top of the gasoline availability issue and communicate at length with the public when a shortfall is anticipated. Last week, Tennessee Governor Phil Bredesen's office rolled out an explanation late Friday, which read like an admonition to essentially stay calm. What was needed was for some arm of the Tennessee government to be more aware than the general populace that this kind of shortage of a very essential commodity was going to happen. The next step would then be to over-communicate the facts to people directly and to the media. The lesson for government is that nature abhors a vacuum. In the absence of good proactive information from our elected leaders on this kind of crisis, people will simply do what feels safe and prudent. This may not always be the right answer. It is all too likely this kind of issue will become more a fact of modern life and not less of one. Our world is changing in its disposition towards energy consumption, which is a very positive thing. At the same time, current energy sources are becoming scarcer and now subject to the whims of natural disasters. Government cannot make gasoline exist that does not exist. At the same time, as government does with many other issues, it should include fuel availability as one of the factors it watches on our behalf. So says the Nashville City paper in an editorial published Monday. Information on long-term fuel availability is also important for government to provide and for the media to over-communicate, as the city paper puts it. Neither of the major presidential candidates has had the courage to warn the country that oil supplies may well be constricted within the decade. And as far as I'm aware, New York Governor David Paterson is the only one of the nation's 50 governors who has addressed peak oil. And oh, it would have been nice to have had some more information about the state of the financial sector before an emergency request for a $1 trillion bailout. I'm Carl Ettinger, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.
You're listening to the Sagebrush Variety Show, sagebrushvariety.org. Political commentary and satire with an irreverent twist from Boise, Idaho. You're listening to the Sagebrush Variety Show, political commentary and satire. Next up, we have Ukiah Digby for coroner.
Hans, Martelline, and a handful of other volunteers who said they were afraid of knocking on doors are pulling large wooden Digby for Coroner signs from the hatchback of Hans's economy car.
The trick is to dig starter holes where the signposts will be positioned, hammer the sign in just lightly, fill the holes in with dirt and a little water around the posts, tamp it down, and then a few more taps on the post with the hammer. I know it seems like a lot of work, but unless we buy the metal bars, which are expensive, this is what the sign team for the first day figured out through trial and error.
Wow, I'm glad you can help us with all this technical stuff. You could help me write a whole new chapter in the campaign manager's manual for grassroots candidates who can't afford to outsource every little task and buy their way out of every problem.
I'm gratified to hear you say that. Now, when it comes to actual sign position, we must remember 30 feet from an intersection, 6 feet in from curb or sidewalk, and in public right-of-way, unless we get permission from a private home or business owner.
Just what do you folks think you're doing here?
We're putting up road signs for the honest and heroic Ukiah Digby who's running for coroner of this great county.
Don't be smart with me, I can see that. But what you don't know, Mr. Smart Aleck, is that these signs and the locations you're choosing are not within highway district regulations.
Well, I don't understand. The signs are more than 6 feet from the sidewalk in a public right-of-way.
Where are you from, son?
Well, I'm kind of embarrassed to admit it, but Meridian, I'm probably moving to Boise next week, though.
There you go again. You know what I mean. Before Idaho.
Düsseldorf.
That's better. Now, you tell me, try and explain why someone from Düsseldorf would know more about signage regulations than myself.
Than I.
What?
Well, just this morning, we covered the topic of the reflexive pronoun in my advanced English grammar class, and I thought I'd share with you that one should only say myself in a self-referential context.
Okay, then. Now, try and explain why someone from Düsseldorf would know more about local county signage regulations and American grammar than myself.
Well, I cannot explain that.
I didn't think so. Now, normally, I take improperly placed signs down to the county holding pen unless I come across sign people when they're in the act of improperly installing signs or in flagranto delicto. But since you're being so ornery, I'm afraid I'm going to have to impound these signs.
If you confiscate these and we have to go get them because you have the rules wrong, we are going to file a complaint.
Suit yourself, but for now, say a nawa to these signs.
You're going to get in so much trouble. This is going to be on your permanent record. This will be a black mark on what I bet is already a spotted record.
Got some signs going down the Highway District bullpen. Bring along that new guy Digby running for coroner. The guy in charge of signs is not one of the pros we know. It's some volunteer who thinks he knows the rules better than myself. He's a tricky one, must have been trained in PSYOPs or something. And get this, the guy's from Düsseldorf.
I bet Lyndon Cuttown would like to know his opposition campaign is run by a foreigner. Sounds like a good old-fashioned honest smear campaign in the making to me. Over.
Roger. Well, if he needs any more information, just have him contact myself. Over.
Roger.
What a f***ing jerk. You are correct about the rules, right?
Absolutely. Of grammar and for campaign signs. Also, I'm pretty sure only the highway district is allowed to confiscate signs. He should have called it in. Don't worry, we have more signs in the vehicle. We just put up a new one, and by the time they get back here, they will have looked up the code and discovered that I'm correct. I'm sure they'll be embarrassed, and we'll pick up our confiscated signs on our way home. I can fit it in today's driving loop without adding any significant mileage to today's trip.
You're a genius!
People are not happy about this toilet paper thing.
That's okay. I just got some new intelligence. Digby's got volunteers doing everything we pay people to do, including making and posting yard signs.
That's pathetic.
Indeed. But here's the good part. The guy in charge of all the details is from Dusseldorf. Supposedly, he's an exchange student. So with a little poetic license, we can declare Digby as taking his orders from Germany.
Ugh, even I think that's stupid. Don't you think I'm going to look desperate if I publicly denounce Digby for letting some exchange student make his homespun signage?
Not necessarily. Corina Graham almost unseated an incumbent senator last year by revealing that he was born in Canada. A lot of foreign-hating voters never even heard the part about his family being in Canada on assignment for the U.S. military when his mom went into labor. But anyway, just in case people think it's unseemly for us to bring it to light, we're going to assign this job to Lodi. He can redeem himself for the near disaster he caused the family and flag picnic.
I don't think you should trust Lodi Tundep with any more assignments.
No, he's perfect. I'll explain later. I'm calling him right now.
Hello?
Lodi, this is Lyndon.
Listen, I don't have time to get chewed out about that water slide thing.
Forget about that. That's water under the bridge. I got a new task for you.
You don't say.
I need you to write a letter to the editor.
You caught me just in time. You know, the Idaho Registry and Columnary prints only one letter to the editor per person per month. Of course, I manage to get an extra in now and then by giving my hound dog's name and my cell phone number, but I like to save those up for emergencies. Anyway, I was just sitting down to write my monthly clarion call against the United Nations' continuing attempts to control the United States. What do you want me to give that up for?
Well, this is practically the same thing. Digby's sign guy is from Dusseldorf. And word is, he's defying local law authority and has a suspicious, exhaustive knowledge of Idaho loopholes and is trying to warp our American grammar. His campaign is being run from Germany.
That's despicable. I can write this one with my eyes closed.
Well, don't be a show-off. Just write something good. Let me know if you need any suggestions and please call me and read it to me before you send it off. Okay?
I think I might be insulted by that. And you should know our policy is that no editorial changes can be made to a written piece. But since I sort of owe you one, I'll give you a call.
Thank you. Umatilla Kennewick for Coroner.
I really outdid myself this time. It's all there, and in under 200 words.
Let's hear it.
Just as the price of liberty is eternal vigilance, so too then is the price of American sovereignty my eternal reminders that the United Nations, the so-called Green Movement, and the conspiracy to spay and neuter domesticated animals are an unholy trinity, hurtling us towards a new satanic world order. It is well known and thoroughly documented that mouse-like aliens, who call themselves the Incandati, arrived on this planet 326 years ago, taking human form and quickly taking over the entertainment industry worldwide. Their agenda is to reduce the human population to just enough to maintain the huge tracts of seized, federally designated wilderness, which will serve as their nests. And they have headquarters in Ukiah, California, and Dusseldorf, Germany. Can it be coincidence that local candidate for coroner, Digby, was given the first name of Ukiah at birth, and that members of his inner circle come from Dusseldorf? Or that he was a salary consultant for the state of Montana's National Appropriate Technology Assistance Service, the acronym of which is Satan, spelled backwards. Or that he worked in the entertainment industry as a musician and a soap opera actor. The facts are there. You decide.
That's perfect.
Thanks. you know, I have a lot of influence with my letters to the editor.
I'm sure you do. Listen, don't tell anyone you're volunteering for us. For your own safety, that is. I can't say any more.
I'll read ya. Bye.
So what's this letter like?
I can't really repeat it, or paraphrase it, or describe it.
You're making me nervous. Even with my considerable war chest, we cannot afford any more fuck-ups.
Oh, we'll deny he has anything to do with our campaign. In the words of the great Ronald Reagan, just because he supports us, doesn't mean we support him. And who better to sow paranoia amongst his kind? And believe it or not, that's a sizable number of voters. Furthermore, when the average voter sees this kind of garbage getting bandied about, it makes them disgusted with the whole electoral process, and they stay home in droves. The fewer self-informed and independent-minded voters that go to the polls, the higher the percentage of our local followers.
Sounds like more campaign manager pseudo-tactics to me, but I'll believe it when it works. And I know how badly you'd hate to ruin your perfect record of managing winning campaigns.
Everything is under control.
Candidate Ukiah Digby and his campaign image consultant and significant other, Travis Boney Maroney, are seated at a fancily set table for dinner.
So Travis, I meant to tell you that I talked to Harry Glock last week, and he said to say hi.
Oh, and why would you be talking to Harry?
I was responding by phone to a voter survey they sent out.
Oh, Firearms Voters United?
Right. He said, you've been a bachelor long enough, and it was time for that to change. And I was about to tell him I've been trying to get the same message across to you, but then I realized we were probably not talking about the same thing.
Oh my. I'm not sure the don't ask, don't tell policy is working with that crowd. It's tempting to go completely out, but it could mean sacrificing a lot of things I care about.
You know, as much as I don't like the idea of shooting pudgy little birds with cute head ornamentation, I do think it would be nice if someday a person who is very good at murdering, bagging, chucker, and has administrative and public relations skills to boot can be the president of the Chucker Stalkers Club, for instance, even if he is an openly gay man. You know, just as a first step towards a bright future of equal...
Yes, well... I know where this is going, but this is date night, not lecture night, right?
Right. So, tonight, I've made a beet and apple salad, herbed roasted vegetables, and portobello Wellington. It's got leeks and mushrooms and a puff pastry.
Wow. You almost make veganism seem attractive. Dang, this is really good.
Thanks.
As usual.
Flattery will get you far.
Well, I hate to ruin my record then by living up to my title as image consultant.
Is there something wrong with how I present?
As an actor and musician and gay man, I think you know it's all drag. You dress yourself just fine when we go out to the Rainbow Lounge, and you fit right in when you go to your revolutionary meetings, but I'm afraid your Idaho politician drag needs work.
Martellene says, everyone knows I'm not one of the usual suspects, so I might as well go for a less buttoned-down look.
I agree, but we need to get you closer to the general universe, even if that sometimes means elements of style you and I would normally consider bad taste.
Bad taste? Like what?
You need to wear short-sleeves dress shirts until mid-October.
No!
Yes! Why not? I mean, you have the arms for it.
Nice try at tarting up the bad news with compliments. Okay, I'll try to style down and add more polyester to my palette if you think it will make people pay more attention. Especially now that I'm not just running on general principle, but have some specific issues.
Oh, really? Like what?
Like that the Oregon Providers of Idaho and America Free Trade Agreement Lobby, or OPIAFTA, gives Umatilla monthly donations year-round, whether or not she has an opponent or is even campaigning. It's totally legal, so long as she uses it to defray ordinary and necessary expenses incurred in connection with her duties, and stays under the generous legal donation limit. She arranges a lot of lucrative body part sales from deceased who've signed organ donor cards. Then the organs go to plastic surgery clinics, and, get this, the charges, which are right on the campaign spending report, include stuff like 3 martini lunches at Le Fondue and shoe purchases from Bella Crespo's.
But they all do that.
That's exactly what I'm trying to change. The perception that they all do that, and there are no trustworthy citizens running for office, and it'll always be that way.
What I was saying is that she has more Manolo Blahnik shoes than any woman or drag queen in town, and even her considerable war chest can't cover that. The truth is, she's got more deals than that going.
There's more? Like what?
Well, just last year, she sold over 500 pairs of corneas to the McGillicuddy Eye and Tissue Transplant Bank. Something like 80% of the donors were immigrants who never even signed a donor card. McGillicuddy resells the product at $3,400 a pair, and then $335 worth of shoes or chocolate or even cash shows up at Kennewick's door. You almost have to admire her resourcefulness.
And why didn't you tell me this before? I admit, naming you image consultant was just my way to convince Martellin to let me still have date night during the campaign. Not to mention as a way to let us be seen together at public places while you continue to have one foot in the closet. But I do expect you to care a little about my campaign, and I can't believe you would keep something that is obviously so important to me a secret.
Slow down. Don't say anything we'll both regret. First of all, I didn't literally mean I admire her. I was just saying it's impressive that... Never mind. Anyway, I didn't tell you because you said you didn't want to run an attack campaign. And besides, everyone already knows about it. And no one has done anything, so I guess everyone figures that a few side deals to supplement her salary is worth overlooking in order to keep a reliable coroner.
Supplement her salary? It's six figures!
Well, just barely.
Oh!
I mean, there would be a nice raise for you.
You are on such thin ice right now.
I'm just kidding.
Well, don't. So you mean to tell me all 300,000 county residents, many of whom could vote if they were sufficiently motivated or outraged, already knew about this? Because I'm really amazed that after over a decade of living here, I'm the only one in town who had no idea. And that my campaign manager, who graduated nearly top of her class in a highly rated political science program, hasn't turned up anything in her research.
Of course, people don't know about it. And obviously, Martellin isn't going to just stumble on the paper trail. But I mean, the Attorney General knows about it, but since no one has ever filed a complaint, and Jenny Jett at the elections office, and of course her husband Kenny, the clerk at the elections office, but it's their job to make sure everyone knows the rules and gets the forms, not to put anyone on trial. And of course, the editor of the paper knows about it, but I mean, that kind of story won't sell as many papers as the fact that Richie Debs from TV's emergency room left his fourth wife supermodel, Renita Burtko, for the young and upcoming actress Presley King after working together on the set of Death Blow 3, Vengeance is Mine. And that Presley is rumored to have been engaged to the Prince of England at the time.
Oh, brother, I can't believe you follow that crap. Anyway, I've got to focus on winning this election so I can convince other people from my campaign to run for attorney general and elections office and replace whatever other officials look the other way while Kennewick profits from illegal trade of body parts.
You're so attractive when you're all fired up. Oh yeah, I just remembered, she also was known for scamming drugs from the dead. My friend Dale Everson, he used to be deputy coroner, and he told me leftover prescriptions are normally counted, logged, and ultimately destroyed after death investigations, but Kennewick would take prescription bottles out of her purse and put the prescription medicines into aspirin bottles. I don't know if she uses any herself, but I do know she sells a lot to that right-wing radio talk guy, Finch Hurlbutt.
Ow! Ouch!
All right, Ukiah. You've convinced me that graft insider dealing and stealing from corpses are all wrong, even if that's been business as usual for some time, but now I really think you're overreacting.
No, it's my tooth! Ah! Don't tell me I'm overreacting about my politics. Ow, this fucking
I'm
tooth.
Sorry! Let's get you to the dentist. I know a dentist I can call who will meet us in his office for emergency work.
Thank you. Ow!
Hey, in the meantime, maybe we can stop at Umatilla's house and see if she can give you something for the pain.
That's kind of funny, actually. I do appreciate your sense of humor in times of emergencies. One of the reasons I do manage to love you. Ah! Ah!
The scene is the county clerk's office. Martellin Mascarpone, Ukiah Digby's campaign manager, is seated at a tiny elementary school-style desk and chair that's all one piece. She is struggling to work with several stacks of documents which threaten to spill off the desk.
Here's the documents you requested.
Are you sure you can't make copies of these or put them on a floppy disk so I can take them with me? They are public documents.
We could, but we'd have to charge you 19 cents a page for copying or $37 per floppy disk. And we're very busy right now, as you can see.
I'm the only one in the elections office, and my candidate is the only contested election in the county. It doesn't look busy to me.
I have a lot of pencils to sharpen before 4:30.
Can you at least find me a better desk to work at?
The county works on a very tight budget. This is all the furniture we have.
Fine. You can go now.
Jenny Jett, the elected official for overseeing all elections and elected officials, specifically told me to make sure no one walks off with our documents.
Can you watch me from the pencil sharpener while you work? Maybe you can sharpen your quota that way. I can't concentrate with you looming over me.
Okay.
This is strange. There sure are a high percentage of organ donors with Spanish surnames, considering the small size of that population in this state. And the handling fees from the tissue bank just don't seem to match up with the numbers of potential donors. Either the coroner's office isn't processing the organs, or they're not making the fees they should, or something else is happening to all that cash. I wonder. Doh, my pencil broke again. Hey, can I borrow one of those pencils?
I'm afraid I have to say no. These are county pencils, and they're very thoroughly inventoried. I could lose my job. But I suppose I could let you use the electric sharpener.
This pencil is already just a stub.
What does the sign over my desk say?
It says, your poor planning does not constitute our emergency.
Right.
Honestly, we pay taxes for this office.
You just moved here. You haven't paid taxes yet.
Never mind. Now, where was I? Oh, hey, are these all the records for prescription drug disposal?
Ugh, I'm trying to concentrate.
You're sharpening pencils.
Miss Jett likes it just so. I don't know why you sent me over here if you're gonna keep interrupting me. Anyways, I gave you everything.
Okay, thanks. I guess. It seems like there should be more drug disposal for this number of terminal disease cases. I mean, I know the doctors in an anti-drug state are very hesitant to give pain relievers, even to cancer patients, but this is way low. I wonder if she's pocketing.
Could you please set your cell phone to vibrate?
Whatever. Ukiah Digby for Coroner, Martellene Mascarpone speaking.
Why, hello, my dear.
Lyndon, what could you possibly want?
Dinner and a movie with you, followed by, who knows?
You're a sexist pig. I wouldn't date you in a million years.
Even if I had tickets to the premiere of Dragon Slayer?
You have tickets to Dragon Slayer? People have camped out dressed like druids for the last 9 days to get those tickets. Wait a second. I wouldn't go with you to the gala opening of the Troll King if you were seated next to Wally Tom himself.
Please. I'm a sci-fi fan too. Any of us would do anything to sit next to the man who plays Flobo the Troll King in the Troll King trilogy. And the Grand Magus in TV's Star Battle 4400. Anyways, I was just kidding, so save your coy flirtation. Obviously, I'm not calling you for a date. I'm calling you because it's that time in a heated campaign when opposing campaign managers meet to negotiate the terms of battle. Surely you heard of that tradition in the course of your studies in that top political science program of yours. Between pajama parties, that is.
Pajama parties? What are you talking about? I know opposing campaign managers meet sometimes, but that's for mercenary consultants. I'm running a grassroots campaign to make that kind of cynical campaigning a thing of the past.
Don't be a fool, my dear. Even Captain Janeway of the Starship Voyager met with the evil Borg Queen.
That was television, Lyndon, not reality.
Art reflects life, my dear.
There's nothing to bargain over. The Digby campaign is going to clean your clocks this November.
Let's cut the crap, Marlene. You can't afford not to hear me out. I know you're in the clerk's office doing OPPO research as we speak, and while you might find something a little incriminating, I know things about Digby that will curl your hair.
Hold on a second. Hey, pencil sharpener boy! Don't think you'll get away with calling Lyndon to tell him I was here. You have made an enemy today.
I didn't do anything.
Where did I put that tape recorder? Oh, here it is. You were saying, Mr. Cuttown, that someone has been giving you insider knowledge of my dealings with the county clerk?
I don't recall saying anything of the kind. I really want to meet with you to have a collegial discussion on making sure our campaign continues to be above board and conducted with dignity and integrity.
Just say what you need to say over the phone.
Oh, really, Miss Mascarpone? Well, I don't mind at all that you're most likely recording this conversation, as I have nothing to hide. I simply must insist on the more civilized approach of a face-to-face meeting. Shall we say in 15 minutes at Mega Java?
I will not set foot in Mega Java. That chain puts neighborhood coffee shops out of business, and they refuse to serve fair trade coffee, organic milk, or soy products of any kind.
Very well. I'll be at Marley Turk's. You'll have no trouble picking me out of the crowd of demoralized liberals brooding over their lattes, I'm sure.
Bye.
Oh, and Marlene.
What?
Don't trip over yourself in your rush to come and see me.
Don't make me laugh.
Hey, my pencil!
The scene is Marley Turk's coffee shop. Lyndon Cuttown is the only one in the crowded shop alone at a table. He has a smug look on his face as he loudly slurps at his enormous bowl of hot cocoa. Marlene Mascarpone enters and joins Lyndon at the table.
Marlene, so glad you could make it. May I say you look lovely this evening?
Whatever.
However, may I humbly suggest that you try something different with your hair? Perhaps a Princess Leia style. I surmise that with that hair, you would be even more fetching than Carrie Fisher herself.
Oh, please.
As you can see, I've taken the liberty of having a mocha prepared for you. I hope you relish it as much as I.
Cut to the chase.
As you wish. What, if I may ask, do you think you have on Miss Kennewick?
You'll have to wait until you read it in the papers and see it on the TV news like everyone else. Although, I think you already know.
My dear, there isn't a working politician in all the land who hasn't covered up a minor traffic violation, bounced a check or two, or inadvertently committed some minor misappropriation of funds. But honestly, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Right. What do you think you have on Ukiah?
I have it on good authority that Mr. Digby has been known to flout Idaho's sodomy laws. In fact, he's probably doing just that at this very moment.
Everyone has flouted Idaho's sodomy laws.
Methinks you overestimate our citizenry. Forget all those crazy liberated notions you picked up at your East Coast pajama parties. You're no longer residing in a free love, communist, metrosexual, bisexual, homosexual, agenda-driven state.
What is it with you and pajama parties?
I knew your Digby was not a family values candidate, but I now know that he is guilty of the love that dare not speak its name.
Guilty? Love that dare not speak its name? Who are you?
Lyndon Cuttown, at your service.
Lyndon, you're not impressing me.
Perhaps not, but you appear a bit flush to me. It's very attractive. In fact, you look, shall I say, stimulated.
If you're trying to tell me that Ukiah Digby is gay, I already know that. It's no secret. He's very active in the LGBT community. He's chaired the Pride Week Planning Committee for the past 5 years, he's a coordinator for the Community Center, lobbies on behalf of the Diversity Coalition, and volunteers for the Rainbow Education Program.
Maybe so, but most voters try very hard to avoid even knowing such things exist. When we go public with it, your support will plummet. Believe me, you will wish you had cut a deal. Now, if you tell me what you think you have on Umatilla, perhaps in my beneficence, I'll consider giving you a break. But only because I'm a generous and soft-hearted man, especially when it comes to young ladies. I already know you're in no position to bargain, but I'll hear you out.
Well, I'm not bargaining, but just for the fun of seeing your reaction, I'll tell you that I know all about Umatilla's semi-legal and illegal and legal but unethical body parts trading deals, and I know she's nicking some very powerful controlled substances off corpses. And the way we'll tell the story, it won't sound just like corruption. There won't be a dry eye in Idaho after people hear about how she's profiting off their misery and loss. I'm going to advise Digby to concentrate on dead baby stories.
Listen, I'll trade you three of your small-time white-collar peccadilloes for one non-normative personal characteristic.
First of all, you are a cynical bastard. And second of all, if you call it a trade, you're dreaming.
If I'm dreaming, it's only of pajama parties and pillow fights.
What?
Oh, I think you know. You have a lot of potential in this business, Marlene. You can play the angel all you like, and you certainly look the part. But I can see you've got the killer instinct. Don't waste your talents on these dead-end do-gooder types. Come over to the dark side.
You might think you're cute by calling yourself the dark side, but the truth is you really are evil. I'm going to teach you a lesson.
Oh, please do.
Don't taunt me, you condescending, chauvinistic jerk! I'm going to end your sordid little career and your candidates, too. In fact, I'm going to take down all your kind. Just you wait. You'll be sorry we ever met.
I'll never be sorry for that.
Tune in next week for the next episode of Ukiah Digby for Coroner on the Sagebrush Variety Show.
One of the crops that's already been firmly established in the Sagebrush Variety Show farm's new location is arugula. This site, and its farmer, was still in the soil building and experimental stage. And of the handful of crops that did well here, arugula was growing faster than its caretaker could eat it, and indeed grew to several feet height, at which point it becomes distinctly inedible. It was taking over much of the land. Under the new consolidated farm plan, the Sagebrush players pulled up as much of the root systems as we could, composting the roots and leaves and bagging whatever seed hadn't already blown away, and replanting them in promising sites around town. Keep your eyes peeled for wild arugula in a public place near you for a Johnny Arugula Seed Gorilla Garden freegan meal. Of course, we missed several root systems, and those came up as soon as the weather got warm, with the self-seeded sprouts following a few weeks after. This was all according to plan. The leaves sprouting from old roots are much stronger in flavor than the newly seeded plants, but as arugula connoisseurs, we enjoy blending the vintages, much like vintners are sometimes given to bottling a Malbec Syrah or Merlot Cab blend. At this point, we're already bagging arugula salads for ourselves, Bucky Bacaw's chickens, and friends of the Sagebrush players. In a month or two, we'll be harvesting it faster than we can get rid of it, and by August, we'll be letting a few plants provide us with seed stock for next year and composting the rest. The incredible thing is that this edible weed, the crop we're quite fond of, but also plant to hedge our bets against all the veggies that actually take thought and real effort, costs something like $2 an ounce in the handful of local stores that even sell it. And it is widely reported to us that the stuff on sale pales to the stuff we're handing out as fast as we possibly can. Arugula is only one of the delicious and nutritious simpleton crops that corporate groceries sell at inflated prices for substandard product. Rhubarb, tomatillo, salad dandelions, mint, or just a few other examples. All Sagebrush staples. These are all things that are desirable when cut fresh out of your backyard, or your friend's backyard, but which don't fit well into the corporate model of monocultured tracts of land, growing uniform, hybridized food product, and half-soil, half-petrochemical mediums, harvested factory-style, and distributed in climate-controlled boxes of various size through thousand-mile networks of warehouses and distribution centers. We reviewed arugula last year, on the first-ever Sagebrush Farm Report, and we're reviewing it again because one of the joys of urban homesteading is in celebrating the taste swings that come from working collaboratively with microclimates and seasonal variations to discover the best crops for each time and place by planting broadly and adventurously. Where we may have compared last year's white carrots to a fumé blanc, this year's may taste more like apple cider vinegar or week-old durian fruit. We discover new flavors and possibilities every year. And in that, we're discovering the paradox that having nature choose your ingredient list and building the menu around that somehow feels more empowering than walking under the fluorescent lit concrete block and checking off items from your recipe card. Or maybe it's not a paradox. Can it be that, despite what we're told again and again and again by advertisements, that capitalism is not really about providing us with whatever we desire, but about making us desire stuff from the small range of choices that can be sold at big profit margins? Here's our reaction to this year's crop of arugula.
Bitter and pungent, this gregarious green would make a fine sandwich.
A leafy green bit of goodness, arugula is peppery but not overly so. The long, thin leaves sit on my plate, adding another splash of green to the simple lettuce already located there. The greens together exhibit an earthy, yet satisfying aroma that tantalizes the senses and leaves you wanting more.
This assertive, vintage leaf imposes its wild, dandelion-esque attentions in a bold gambit to overpower the unsuspecting taster. The degree of pepper bite falls just tantalizingly short of a savage assault. As the Stephen Crane poem says, it is bitter, but I like it because it is bitter and because it is my heart.
The faintly sour brightness of this leaf is partially overtaken by its mellow, earthy bite. With its soft intensity, young arugula is easily my favorite green.
A tart and sassy little green that dominates the palate as it does the garden patch. Its texture and shape are distinct among its peers. If you don't control it, it will run roughshod over your whole yard while announcing, "Do I have your attention now, punk?"
Loneliness being one of the hallmarks of the human condition, after, of course, hunger, the Sagebrush Variety players would really love to hear from you. Reactions to the farm report, questions about subsistence gardening, particular plants, your own tales of cultivating and culinary heroics and mishaps, pictures of your garden we can post on our blog, stuff like that. Show some solidarity and email us at sagebrush@radioboise.org. Keep tuning in for more farm reports and, whenever possible, resist corporate food.
You're listening to the Sagebrush Variety Show, political commentary and satire, with an irreverent twist.
Sometimes, when we try to honor a tradition by protecting it, we end up strangling it with our rules and regulations. In this week's essay, Rachel Snellingham, tireless defender of corporate rights and the American way, brings us back through the colorful history of creative get-out-the-vote efforts of yesteryear, with an eye for what could increase participation today.
It's no secret that people are losing interest in participatory government. Voter turnout has been declining steadily at the polls, even on American Idol. They no longer bother to have their tiny yay or nay say at the ballot. They're tired of dancing through the whole boring ballot-punching ritual, and who can blame them? Who really has the time to fill out a whole half-sheet voter registration form and send it in? I don't. Unfortunately, all this red tape is the inevitable byproduct of letting the big government manage it. Clearly, there is only one solution. Privatize elections. Far from being a radical change, this would merely be a return to the traditions of the past. Traditions that worked. Few people realize that political participation was at its peak in the mid-1800s to early 1900s. The electorate was enthusiastic and engaged. While this enthusiasm would occasionally burst into exuberant riots and spirited gang warfare, this was merely an indication of the strong attachment people felt to their candidates and parties. People voted early and often, and the people they put into office knew it and thanked them for it. As George Washington Plunkett, elected by the famous Tammany Hall voter movement, put it, "If there's a fire on 9th, 10th, or 11th Avenue, any hour of the day or night, I'm usually there with some of my election district captains as soon as the fire engines. If a family is burned out, I just get quarters for them, buy clothes for them if their clothes were burned up, and fix them up till things get running again." This system of reciprocation was fueled by many inventive voter mobilization efforts and the passion of the constituents. So committed were many of the voters that they would not merely vote once before getting on with their day, but would vote repeatedly throughout the day, often with multiple ballots each time. These repeaters would vote on behalf of those who were unable to come to the polls themselves or hadn't yet managed to do so. Many would go to the extent of wearing different changes of clothes or facial hair to plausibly seem to be other people. One particularly eager repeater posing as Bishop Dewin threatened to punch the lights out of a poll worker who tried to hinder his democratic participation. While the large cities were best known for their unconventional efforts, rural areas pioneered their own. They were among the first to institute Help America's Dead Vote efforts and Get Out the Vote endeavors with household pets and livestock that would later catch on across the country. Repeaters would cast their votes for those unable to exercise their rights alone on the basis of their status as deceased Americans, fictitious characters, children, or domesticated animals. Among the dead participating in this program were America's founding fathers. In Philadelphia, it was said of Washington, Jefferson, and others, "These men, these fathers of American liberty, voted down here once, and they vote here yet." Such efforts were so thoroughly successful because candidates could be relied upon to give something back to their voters. In addition to charity in times of need and constituent service once they were elected, they would often pay constituents for each vote they cast, in either coffee, cider, or cash. Because these incentives were usually paid from the public coffer, such systems could be viewed as a rudimentary tax refund system. Clearly, such bold strategies could only arise from the dynamic realm of self-interest, that is, the private sector. Sadly, such avenues to engage voters have been largely regulated out of existence. If we ever want to return to the days of such overwhelming popular participation in government, we must loosen up restrictions to allow the natural successors of the political machine bosses, the corporations, to step back into their place. Current efforts to engage corporate citizens must be preserved, but with the recognition that this alone will not be enough. While the ability of corporations to donate to campaigns partially compensates for their inability to vote, we must take a firm stand against donation limits. Corporations must be able to engage voters through media outlets to persuade them to vote on their behalf. Any attack on this right is an attack on the rights of corporations generally and Americans' right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of profit. Still, our ability to finance or launch huge media campaigns is mainly useful for winning votes from one side to the other. If we are to ever hope to attain the grand voter turnout of yesteryear, we must be allowed to motivate individual voters by offering material incentives. Our Constitution accords each American a vote. If an American wants to sell that vote, telling them they can't is nothing short of a slap in the face of freedom. So do the right thing. Do the American thing. Lobby your representatives to protect the rights of Americans and the corporations that want to buy their votes.
This essay was brought to you by Secretary of State Penny Esursa and Assistant Ben Esursa, the Friends of Catherine Harris Foundation, and Diebold Voting Machines, Incorporated.
This week's Sagebrush Variety Show was conceived, written, performed, and produced by Robert McMinn, Kevin Bayhouse, April Hoy, and Gwen Sankirico, and was funded in part by a grant from the Green Institute. For more information on the content discussed on this program, visit our website at sagebrushvariety.org. Write to us at sagebrush@radioboise.org. Thanks for listening to the Sagebrush Variety Show.